this on? No. Is it on? Check 1, 2. Check. Okay, yeah. I'm Wendell. I'm living loved by God. I'm recovering from spiritual and emotional abuse and addiction to food and work and control. I've had issues with pornography and alcohol and rage and panic and depression. I'm representing tonight. Hotel Inc. Go down and check them out. There's some good people doing some good stuff down there. Several of us here volunteer down there, and several are going to volunteer, so it's a good place. We're talking about Christmas. We're talking about when Christmas hurts. And we told you last Sunday night that the lesson we do is following the Monday night session that you already had at Greenwood. So Matt will remind you again during the announcements, but we'll tell you there's a Monday night session at 6, I think, right? 6 at Greenwood. And it talks about when Christmas hurts. It talks about the struggles we have at Christmas because it's not happy for everybody. And so this is the second session in that. And it's entitled The Empty Spot. And I'm just going to read part of what you would get in the workbook or what you had Monday night and then make a few comments about that. The Empty Spot. So what about facing family Christmas when someone who has always been part of the mix is no longer there? Death, distance, dementia. If you're returning to your family of origin, there might even be assigned seats, and the empty spot screams that something is wrong. Any holiday when families typically gather comes with the unspoken expectation that the way it is is the way it should always be. To alter that for any reason is to do grievous damage to the universe. In small increments, this is challenging yet acceptable. Think about it. Kids grow up 1 year at a time, which means gift choices slowly change. It also means more seats at the big people's table and fewer at the little kids' table. Kids' childish squeals of delight are slowly replaced with simple nods of gratitude. But when something explodes, like death or illness or unexpected distance, emotions go rogue. The empty spot becomes the focal point instead of all the potential happiness that could happen. Nobody knows for sure what to say. What's appropriate? Do we collectively process our emotions? Do we act like nothing's wrong? There is no manual for this. There was a pattern to things when they were with you. They always made the gravy, or they read the Christmas story, or they would sit on the floor and help the little ones negotiate scotch tape and the complexities of knotted ribbons. Maybe they were the alpha, in a good way or maybe not so good way. Now who's in charge? Who initiates? Who is the peacekeeper? Who is the translator? Suppose you're facing something like this for the first time this year. Are you afraid? Are you angry? Are you confused? Do you know where you fit into this readjustment? Are there things you'd like to say but are unsure they'd be appropriate? Are there feelings you'd like to express but can't? The group you're in tonight, which is the Monday night group, is a good place to explore these questions, and tonight's a good night too. Or this may be old hat to you. You face numerous Christmases with the empty spot, yet it is not 1 ounce easier than it was the first time. Why isn't it getting any better? You thought time healed all wounds. Is there hope that Christmas will ever return to normal? So we're talking about facing Christmas with grief, the grief of loss. And there are a lot of different reasons why we might grieve at Christmas. You know what? I've seen people get divorced and it's just clean and quick and it happens real easy. Then other divorces happen, marital divorces happen, and the breakup takes years to be complete. And it's sloppy for years. In Christmas gatherings, Thanksgiving gatherings, any kind of family gatherings, the divorce is confusing. Who's invited? Who's not invited? You know, sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's not. But divorce can be very confusing, and it can feel, it carries with it grief. There can be just distance. With our active military these days, you've got people across, you know, way far away in harm's way. You can have people away in college. You might have somebody at a distance just because they're miffed at you. I'm not going home this year. That hurts. There's distance. There's dementia. Have you all dealt with that at all? That you have somebody there, but they're not there. They're there, but they have no clue what you're talking about. They're there, but they're confused. That's a whole other set of issues. How do you deal with that? There's death. You know, I know there's several people right here in this room tonight who will face their first Christmas without a close loved one. That's just tough. What? How do you handle that? What do you do? There's drama. That's probably if you're making a piece of pie and cutting them up into slices, this would be the biggest piece of pie. There's family drama that causes empty spots. They're there, but they're not there, and they're not there, but not because of dementia. They're there because they're under protest. There's the folded arms. There's the pouting. There's the passive aggressive stuff. You know, so how do you deal with that, with them physically being there, but they're giving clear signs that I don't want to be here. You know, there's all kinds of ways that loss can grieve us at Christmas time. So to just say it's the death of a loved one is pretty simple-minded. There's so many other things that go into this feeling of grief at Christmas, which is just just stop. If you got grandkids, or you've got young people or you've got people who are just, some people are just perpetually giddy about Christmas. You know, they just love Christmas. It's disgusting. it's like, really? You know, they show up with a stupid Santa hat on them and the funny shoes with the bells on. And you're like, really? Really? Or they want to sing all the time. It's like, no, please don't. But you have that. You think about that. You have that. And then on the other hand, you've got just raw, bleeding out emotion of grief for whatever reason, divorce, dementia, whatever it is, death. That's such a strange mix. I mean, when you know, they've come out with all kinds of desserts that mix hot with sugar, you know, two contrasting. You've got meals where you have flavors that are this extreme flavor and that extreme flavor, and they go together, they mix. When people have told me, maybe everybody always did this, I don't know, she puts grape jelly on her sausage biscuit. Well, I never heard of that before. When we got married, she gets out the grape jelly and puts it, and I'm thinking, what are you, and she ate tomatoes with scrambled eggs. And it was like, okay, but so there are strange things that people mix. Oh, yeah. That when you try them, you realize, oh, I see why they do this. It works. Okay? So when you're fixing a menu or you're preparing things to eat, it's like, no, you're not going to do that. And they do it and you try it and it's like, now I know why you do that. But Giddy's carol singing Santa Clauses with mom just died or dad just died. This, can you think about how that is so strange? That is such an odd mix. And it's maybe 10 years from now, you'll turn around and look and say, that was just comical in a way, but it's not now. It's not comical. What am I supposed to do? We got little grandkids. When they come in the house, you're so happy and so giddy. And then you have this stab of feeling of, oh, but so-and-so's gone. And so your emotions are just like bouncing off the wall because they can go to two such extremes. And the other part of it is that you don't want to be just a Debbie or a Danny Downer, you know. Well, don't you dare have a good time, because I'm sad. So you know, it's, you don't want to do that. So that really leads to the next. I only have 3 points tonight. That was point one. Here's point two. There is no manual for processing grief. And that sucks because there's a ton of books written on anger management and fear management and anxiety management and depression management and everything. But when it comes to grief, the books I've read are like, really? Really? When my first wife was dying, it took 2 years for her to die after the diagnosis. When they said it was cancer, and I was young, I was not even 30 yet, but I was not stupid either. And I thought, this is already all over her. They were trying to be nice to me and everything, but I realized she's not going to make it. They didn't just remove a little lump from her breast. This is systemic. This is all over, you know. And so I'm trying to process this with a little girl who's 18 months old down in Middle Tennessee where my family all lived somewhere else. Nobody lived close. And I'm trying to process. This is not for you to feel sorry for me. That's not where we're going with this. I remember thinking, I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. I literally thought, if somebody could put a blueprint down for me or a manual and tell me this is the next appropriate step for you to take, or feeling for you to feel, or words for you to say. There was nothing. I didn't know how to handle the grief, and nobody was stepping up and saying, let me help you. There were plenty of people who kept saying, I'm just going to tell you this. If you know somebody who's grieving because of somebody else, don't always ask about the somebody else. Everybody was, how's Carol doing? How's Carol doing? And I'm thinking, why doesn't anybody ever ask how I'm doing? And I know that sounds awful selfish. I was 28 years old. To me, I was a kid, you know. If you're 28 here, I'm sorry, I don't mean to insult you, but I'm 62 now, and I'm looking back at that, I'm thinking, I'm just a kid back then. And why didn't anybody ever ask how I was doing? So that's just a little word for whoever's listening. If you know somebody who's dealing with an ailing person or a terminal person, don't just ask about the terminal person. Ask how they're doing as well. But anyway, but I remember thinking about, you know, someday I'm going to write a manual on grief. Someday I'm going to write a book to help people handle grief. And I've never done that because the older I've gotten, the more I've realized there are no two grieving processes that are the same. Everybody deals with it different. There are similarities. There are broad similarities, but there are no two templates that you could lay down on top of each other and say, that's a perfect match. And so the one thing I could say from my experience with Carol's death is, don't face grief thinking that you're going to be tested or thinking that somehow you have to get it right. Can you think of that? A 29-year-old young father of a little bitty kid, and I'm grieving my wife, but I'm also thinking, am I doing this right? So this feeling of almost shame, a guilt maybe, on top of grief. What? No. You don't need that. So if you're grieving this year, don't be asking yourself, I wonder if I'm doing this correctly. I wonder if I'm doing this right. You don't need that. Take it from me. You don't need that. You grieve however you need to grieve. If you need to go out and kick a tree, go out and kick a tree. You know, if you need to go out in the field somewhere and just yell at the top of your lungs, go out in the field and do that. You know, you don't want to harm yourself or somebody else, but you can kick a tree. You're not going to harm that tree. You'll quit before the tree gets hurt. Your foot will let you know that's enough. You see what I'm saying, though? Don't lay on top of yourself this expectation of, I got to make sure that I get this grieving thing right. Part of my problem was I was a young pastor. So I had all kind of people watching me, and I was a people pleaser. So I wanted to do the right thing. I wanted to leave a good impression. That is so ridiculous. When my wife dies, I want to make sure I leave a good impression that I did well. But that's where I was. That's exactly where I was. Ain't that fun? Ain't that fun that that's what a pastor would feel? That's not good. So anyway, there are all different reasons for grief, and there's no manual written to help us, tell us how to process grief. You process it the way you want. And I think it helps. There were a few men who had lost their wives unexpectedly. And I talked to them and I found that to be helpful. But most other people, some of the stuff they said was just ludicrous. It was like, really? That's your version of comforting me? But you can find people with similar stories and at least share stories. They're not going to fix you, but it's good to hear their story and it's good to share yours with them. So here's number three. So where are we going to go with our grief? I remember, this is one thing that I did think, and I'm glad I thought it. I think that was a healthy thought. I remember when Carol died, since it took so long for her to pass, I did a lot of my grieving before she actually passed away. And then afterwards, I did some, but not as much. It's really weird. I grieved a little bit after she passed, and then we started dating, and we got married, and we moved on with life. I never really hit the deep part of grief until about 2 years into Celebrate Recovery, when I got into a 12-step group and started opening my story. And I remember the first time I ever shared my story in CR, it was in the MAC, the first time I ever shared my story, you know how we share our stories, and I wrote it down. And I remember writing down the part about Carol's death with, well, I felt a few things, but not much. When I stood in front of everybody and shared that, I broke down. I mean, I lost it. And I don't know if it was because Bethany was there or not, because she doesn't even remember her mom. She has no recollection of her mother. But I don't know if it's because she was there. I don't know. But grief is a weird thing that way, that you think you have it dealt with, and here 20 years later, boom, where did that come from? And still, when I think about Carol sometimes, it'll come back up on me. And so grief is just strange that way. So you have to ask yourself, where are we going to go with this grief thing? There's some people who, boy, this is getting so touchy because I don't want anybody to think I'm stepping on your toes. This does not come from me. I remember literally learning this from a professor in college. I took a death and dying class, of all things. It was a sociology class, but I took a class on death and dying. And he said that people grieve 1,000 different ways. But when a person builds a monument to a deceased person, and that monument is there 10, 15, 20 years later, never changed, it still is this enormous part of their life, that's not healthy. You see what I'm saying? This monument. You need to grieve and you need to take as long as you need to. But if 10, 20, 30 years, well, even 10 years down the line, 5 years down the line, when there's this monument, and boy, I don't want to step on anybody's toes, but you hear of parents who leave their child's room identical to the way it was for like 20 years. Don't go in there. Don't touch anything. Don't do anything. That is probably not a healthy way to process grief. That you need to move on at some point. I learned that from Jay Dargan. You know Jay Dargan. I learned that in Jay Dargan's class on death and dying at Asbury. You remember Jay? Yeah. At Asbury College years ago. But it made sense to me. It made a lot of sense to me. So if we're thinking we cannot, if I allow this grief to go away, it's showing disrespect to my deceased loved one. Do you see what I'm saying? I have to maintain this level of grief or it means I didn't really love them. You catch that kind of reasoning? But that's the kind of reasoning that people use. I have to maintain this intense level. If it fades, that means my love for that person is fading. The two are not the same. Grief is not showing respect to the deceased loved one. Grief is just simply the emotional process that you go through when they're gone. So to move on with a normal emotional life is not disrespectful or lacking in love toward the person who's died. Is everybody hearing that? That's what Jay Dargan was trying to say. That's what that professor in college was trying to say. That to grieve as hard and long as you need to is okay. But after a while, we've got something skewed in our thinking. So to build a monument to them, a monument of grief, if it's in our mind, if it's in a child's untouched bedroom, or if it's in a closet full of clothes, don't touch his clothes. They're there, you know, those were daddy's clothes. Leave them alone. Don't touch them. Don't do anything with them. That's building a monument, and it's not a healthy way to go with it. Is there a remake of The Lion King coming back out, or did I just hear that? Okay, so The Cycle of Life. Do what? All right. The Cycle of Life. The Cycle of Life. We all get it, right? I mean, just a few weeks ago, all the leaves fell out of the trees. They died and they fell to the ground. And now, come spring, they will produce new life as they fertilize the ground. This is the cycle of life. This is the world we live in, the universe we live in. It's the way Jesus even said, unless a kernel of wheat or corn dies and falls to the ground, it will not produce fruit. This is the cycle we're part of. And so, are we just going to survive the death of our loved one? Are we going to get to the end of it and say, well, I made that, I survived it? We talked about this last week. Even our visits home at Christmas time that may be horrendous in our extended family, is the best we're going to be able to say about that is, well, I survived it. On the way home, whew, I survived that. What kind of life do we live when all we ever do is survive the hard spots? That's it. What's your victory cry? What good word have you got for us today? Well, I survived blah, blah, blah. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. I survived a trip home for Christmas. I survived the death of my loved one. I survived. Really? That's it? That's what we're shooting for, is survival? When you think about it, what kind of respect does that show for the deceased loved one? I survived that. It's all about me. You know, it's not showing any respect to them. It's just all about me. Where when you think about the lost loved one, you all know I've got troubles with my dad. I didn't have the best dad story. But the longer he's gone and the more I think about it, the more I keep trying to say, yeah, he did this shit to me. I know that happened. It was hurtful. It was painful. But there was a lot of good stuff my dad invested in me. A lot of good stuff. And so I'm trying to look at that stuff and say, where can we go with that? Instead of grieving the bad stuff that happened, where can we go with the good stuff? How can we cultivate that? How can we fertilize that? How can we make that produce what it can possibly potentially produce? So when you think about the people who are out of your life due to divorce, dementia, distance, death, whatever it is, your story with them can either be, well, I survived that, or it can be, what good can come out of that? What lessons were learned? What things were built into me that would not have been built into me if it hadn't been for my relationship with them? What are the good things? Where can we go with this? And that's hard. If you've had a mixed relationship with somebody, that's hard. Because as soon as you start rehashing your history with them, our human minds always go to the negative. But he said that. Well, she did that. Or he didn't do that, or whatever. So it's hard, it's difficult to say, shut up, I'm going to think of the positive stuff. I already heard you, I don't mean to be pointing at y'all with negative stuff. The Prestons are not negative. They're positive people. It's just these people back here. Okay, negative voices, I've heard you. You've told me your story. Now, positive voices, let's listen to you for a while and hear what you have to say. So we can either build a monument of grief to the deceased loved one. That's what we've concentrated on tonight, is somebody who's died. But we can either build a grief monument to them, which becomes unhealthy in so many ways. It really doesn't show them respect. I'm not sure what it does. It makes it all about me. Or we can say, how can I honor their life? How can I respect their life? How can I really do something with what they invested in me and go on with that? And it's challenging, but we can do it. So Christmas is closer than it was last week. Are we getting ready for Christmas? I mean, I think about it, and it's just weird. You know about all this, but it's just weird that at Christmas time, the only extended family I'd want to see is her. I don't really, you know, I'm just being honest. She's the only one. But I think of my family, our family, you know, our Jake and Bethany and the kids and the in-laws and everything. And every time we're together now, I just want to tell them, don't let what happened in my extended family, and see shaking her head because I'm sure they've had those conversations. Don't let what happened in my extended family happen to our family. If there's a problem, we've got to talk about it. If there's jealousy, Christmas, why would there be jealousy? But there is. If there's jealousy, talk about it, you know. If there's misunderstandings, talk about it. Keep it out in the open so that our family, the Wendell and Robbie family, don't go the same way as the Clyde and B family, as our parents' names, because we are so fractured and scattered and at each other's throats. It's crazy, crazy. So anyway, Christmas is coming. What are we going to do with it? You know, it could be like a sharp poke in the eye, or it could be, hey, let's see where grace can grow here. And if we come from a crappy extended family, let's see what we can do to not let that happen now. So anyway, thank you for listening. We got a Christmas song we're going to do.